Welcome to Crossing the Divide, the official podcast, a grassroots multimedia exploration of the intricacy of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide elevates local voices to educate the community on regional matters and fosters cooperative engagement in overcoming the unique challenges of life west of the Continental Divide. Not New York, not LA. Crossing the Divide is a unique tribute to life in the continental in-between. Support for Crossing the Divide comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. In this edition of Crossing the Divide's official podcast, we'll explore the complexities of modern-day ranching with Catherine Bedell, owner of Roan Creek Ranch. We'll examine potential threats to an iconic Western tradition and discuss Catherine's bold vision for building a sustainable farm-to-table infrastructure that would provide naturally raised meats produced and packaged right here in the Grand Valley. Catherine, welcome to Crossing the Divide.
Thank you.
Let's start by taking a look at your own personal history. You're in Colorado now, but are you a Colorado native?
No, I was actually raised in California and went through school and left California to go to college. So I went to New England for college and then back to California for a master's and a veterinary degree. And as soon as I graduated, I left and came to Colorado.
Now, you mentioned that you graduated with a veterinary degree. So what kind of work were you doing right out of school?
I had an ambulatory practice on the front range, and so I was looking at horses, but most of my practice was cattle and sheep and goats.
The things that you learned in your schooling, how were they being applied to the work that you were doing?
I studied mostly production medicine. And so when I moved to the front range, most of it was small farms and individuals. I didn't work on very many big ranches. So it was a little bit of a change for me from dealing with individuals rather than from production medicine.
At a certain point, you decided to strike out on your own. What led to that decision?
Well, first of all, I got married and had kids. So that sort of always changes a lifestyle for a woman.
Yes, it does.
We also decided at that point to leave the front range and move to a ranch on the western slope. So between all those changes, we started the ranch with cattle and with a hay operation and raising two young daughters. And when you have kids, and I know everybody goes through this, suddenly different things become important to you. And so I had looked at production medicine as, you know, you can do a lot of things and wow, that's so cool. And I never really thought of whether it was something we should do or was making a good product. And when I had kids, that really shifted. I started looking at, is this something we really should be doing or should be putting in our food supply? And that was a pivotal moment for me.
Did the idea of humane treatment of animals come into play at all in any of that?
It did, even through vet school, that you would go on to certain places and just see practices that you never wanted to see happening to animals. And so, it's an emotional time because you're practicing on live animals suddenly and seeing the repercussions of the production systems. So it was really eye-opening for me because I did care about animal welfare a lot. And in a way, it put me off, but it was my chosen career path. So I started to make changes from within.
Animal welfare is a big reason that a lot of people decide to turn away from meat and say lead a vegan or a vegetarian lifestyle. Another reason is this issue of sustainability with factory farming. We know that raising cattle and the meat industry, there are many sustainability issues. We can look at a lot of things. The depletion of the Amazon rainforest. I know a lot of that land is going into raising cattle. We know that it takes a fairly large number of resources, grain, water, fuel, to yield every pound of that beef that we're getting. I'm wondering if you can address some of those issues within the cattle industry and then tell us about how your operations at Roan Creek Ranch are trying to counteract that.
So the beef industry really changed after World War II. Suddenly, we had a huge workforce coming home from serving in the military, and a lot of them went back to their farming operations. Of course, tractors and fertilizer and everything had and that sort of inputs had developed greatly while we were ramping up the war effort. So there was a pivotal shift in the way that we raised food about that time. And because of all that new technology, we started getting more and more what they call efficient in raising meat. So that's when we started tearing out, you know, pasture lands or forests down in the Amazon and putting in monoculture crops to feed cattle. So we're talking sorghum, we're talking corn, and other things that they mix into a feed for cattle. So that was a fundamental change. And since we took that land out of pasture, we had to put the cattle somewhere. So that's when they started ending up in feedlots. So it took less land and you could confine a lot more cattle on a couple acres and then raise feed to feed them. And I'm not sure who decided that was more efficient, but maybe with all the extra resources that we had at that period of time, it was. Recently, there's been a shift away from that because people started looking at animal welfare and a lot, and about how sustainable it was and all the resources that we are sort of wasting to make that 1 pound of meat. So there's really been a pivotal shift really recently. I would say it started 12 years ago and it's really gaining momentum now.
Did part of that expansion of these feedlots, was part of that because in that post-World War II era, we also had an expansion of the middle class, and economically people are in a better position, that they will tend to drive up the demand for things like meat.
Exactly. And that happened here then. And in like China and some of the Asian countries, it's happening now. So the demand for protein, meat and pork and beef, pork and lamb is all increasing sort of in countries that it hasn't been that well consumed.
I had read somewhere that by 2050, they're predicting a double increase in the demand for meat. And so, of course, the question becomes, if we have resources that might be dwindling, but we have this huge uptick in demand, how do we meet that demand?
First of all, in a Western country like ours, we definitely overconsume protein. So we have an abundant source. So shifting to eating more plants is not a bad idea health-wise or because we're overconsuming the resource right now. As far as the increase in population, we already produce enough calories to feed twice the population of the world. It's a matter of making the production of those calories sustainable.
Let's look at this idea of the feedlot versus the grazing and how each of those impacts the environment differently.
So when you're raising animal feed and when you're driving through like Iowa or part of the Midwest, you'll see acre or mile and mile on cornfield. And look at all the corn is a very thirsty crop, so it takes a lot of water. And recently, a lot of pesticides to keep or herbicides to keep it a monoculture and keep the weeds down. So it consumes a lot of resources to raise that corn. Then the corn is harvested and moved to feed to cattle that are confined in a feedlot. And when you look at the opposite of that, leaving the cattle to harvest their own grass, you can already see that, you know, grass grows pretty much ubiquitously across our country through natural rainfall in a lot of places, no irrigation necessary. And you don't need tractors, you don't need the pesticides, you don't need the fertilizer, you don't even need to harvest it, because if you rotationally graze your cattle through the landscape, like the herds of wild bison used to do, you have a stockpile of grass available through the winter. So there's no harvesting of it with mechanically necessary. So you can already see that you're saving on resources to produce the same pound of meat. People have argued that we can't feed the world that way. As I said before, we already overconsume meat. And if we turned a lot of that cropland that's being used to produce cattle feed back into pasture, we actually can feed the world the necessary protein. So that argument really doesn't fly.
In terms of global climate change, we've looked at cattle and the release of methane into the atmosphere. But I did read something recently that talked about how this idea of grazing and eating natural grasses rather than turning that into cropland, when you till that land, you're also releasing some of those gases. Is there an offset there?
So let's look at the cropping system first. So if you watch the land right around your neighborhood, you know, they'll plant corn, they'll harvest the corn, they'll take everything off it, maybe put some cattle on it to eat the husk and stuff, and then they'll immediately till it. So there's not much organic matter, which is carbon, which is what we're trying to put back into the soil. So when you're doing a row crop, you're actually depleting the soils of organic matter and returning nothing. So now let's look at a grazing operation. So when you put cattle on the ground, they eat the grass and then they trample some of it in, which adds organic matter to soil. They produce manure, which adds more to the soil. And I don't have the numbers available, but they actually return more carbon from the soil than they take out by eating it.
I noticed on your website the quote, "You are what you eat eats." I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit more.
Sure. In our production system, the commodity production system of meat, cattle eat the commodity crops that we've been talking about that are treated with fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides, and the cows are consuming that in the feedlot. So we're adding a lot of chemical inputs to our cattle at that level. And then also when you confine them into the feedlot, they're treated with growth hormones, they're given antibiotics so they don't get sick from being overcrowded, and all that chemical is added and is stored in their meat. So when they're slaughtered, even with the withdrawal times that the USDA requires, you still have residues in your meat. So whenever you eat something, you should think about what's been put on or what's been added to that outside of what's on the label.
And too, as you mentioned, cows would naturally graze on the grass. They're not naturally going to eat corn.
No.
So that affects the quality of the meat as well, correct?
When you put something on corn or versus pasture, it actually changes the composition of the meat and the nutritional quality of the meat as well. Because when they're eating a diverse diet of grasses and things that are growing out there, there's a lot of different real trace minerals and things in it that you just don't find in the commodity meat. And the current research shows that once you put a cattle on grain, it only takes 90 days for it to totally change the composition of the meat you're eating. So it's a pretty quick thing. Also, the fat content on the animals really varies from grass, where it has a lot of vitamin E and A, to the commodities where it has less vitamin E and A, and lots of other things that we've discovered are more important to human health.
So when we look at grazing, grass obviously does need water to grow. I would be really interested to know how the cattle industry here in Colorado has been faring throughout this drought, how that affects what you do, and what the long-term outlook might be if these long periods of drought become part of the norm.
Yeah, so this drought's been really hard on people. This winter, here in the West, we depend on public lands a lot for grazing cattle. So we tend to have irrigated ground that we grow hay or use for pasture periodically, and then we turn them out on public lands. The public lands obviously are unirrigated. A lot of water sources dried up this summer because there wasn't enough snowpack to get the springs going or anything like that. So people were hauling water to remote areas to their cattle this year. And then as we move out of the high country down to the desert, because we got no moisture really, but from last winter to now, a lot of those BLM permits and stuff didn't even get open. So they weren't allowed to put cattle on them because there was actually nothing for the cattle to eat because nothing regrew after the last grazing season. So you can see here you have a herd of 400 cattle and nowhere to go with them. Because it's a drought, hay prices are also high. So you can't really afford to to buy hay to feed them just doesn't make economic sense. So people have been thinning their herds, getting rid of some of the older cows and really making a choice to keep what they consider their best cows. Other people have shipped them out of the area, so they'll put them in cattle trucks and take them somewhere where they did get good moisture. So a lot of cattle have gone to the Front Range where they had decent moisture, and down to central New Mexico where they did get summer rains and have some grazing available. Longer term, if this goes on, people will be able to carry less cattle, so fewer numbers of cattle on the range that they normally would run more on.
Now, you had mentioned when we had talked a couple weeks ago that the price per head of cattle has dropped dramatically. How does that affect things then when you have even fewer cattle?
Yeah, it's tough to make a living in the cattle business. The price of cattle in the past, even the past 30 years, has not even kept up with inflation. So every year, compared to anything else you could be doing, you're making less and less money. So while the price has creeped up a little bit, not enough to maintain the lifestyle that people had, you know, even 20 years ago. So it's tough. We're in a bind. And if you own your land outright, you're sitting a little better. If you're trying to lease land, it's still okay because lease land the price tends to follow sort of the value of the product. Buying it or starting out new now is just impossible because you'll never be able to pay for that ranch.
Do you think that is currently the biggest threat to ranching?
One of them, yeah. And there's multiple threats to ranching right now, but that's a key one. Obviously, people aren't going to go into it if you can't make a living at it. And people are not, you know, if you have a giant ranch where you sort of have a very large number of cattle, you're doing all right because the margin is so small, you're still making enough money. Those people that are running, you know, 40 head to 250 head or something are in a bind because they're not making a living at it. They're mostly working an off-farm job to support their farming habit. And obviously, that's not sustainable in itself. So it's going to be something that we have to look at.
The impetus for this podcast came from a Colorado Experience documentary about the sheep and cattle wars, which happened here out west. One of the causes of that was this competition for resources, as I understand, between cattlemen and the shepherds who were running their sheep. When we talked about that briefly, you made a correlation to some issues that the cattle industry is having with the outdoor industry. Could you explain that a little bit more?
So there has been a recent movement to remove cattle from the public lands, claiming that, you know, they destroy the environment, that they're just not good, it's overgrazed. And that argument really doesn't fly when you look at things historically, especially because this country, as everyone knows, had giant herds of migratory animals before we got here. And so the landscape and those grazing animals evolved together. So the grasses need to be grazed to spread out. Unfortunately, it was overgrazed. The turn of the century, the 1900s, the resource was really overused. And so that was the period of the range wars because they were competing for a limited resource and land management knowledge was slim. We've done a lot to improve that already. And so people that argue about removing the cattle from the range or the sheep from the range haven't really looked at the big long-term picture of doing that.
Catherine, why do you think that it is important that consumers have a closer connection to their food and how it arrives on their table?
You know, there's so many reasons that people should be thinking about this. I mean, we can take the most recent one was the contaminated romaine lettuce that came out of, and that they really haven't traced yet to see where it came from. When you're selling food to people that you face every day, you're going to do a good job and make sure it's clean and wholesome to the best of your ability. So that personal connection is really a food safety mechanism for the consumer. That's, you know, how closer can you get to your food than having the person that raised it provide it for you? Plus, regulations tend to be one size fits all. And so, like the romaine lettuce outbreak, there'll be a bunch of new regulations coming down the pipe because of that. And they will affect people that are growing on a very small scale who do a very good job, and how that sort of outbreak would never happen to anybody. But suddenly they're going to have to, you know, test water and wash product and, you know, do all sorts of things that is way more expensive and put a lot of people out of business, actually. So, you know, It's a double-edged sword. You want food to be safe, and I believe that the best way to do that is to buy it from someone face-to-face, or at least, you know, someone in your community where they have a responsibility to treat their neighbors well.
And the fewer number of hands that touch that product from the time it's slaughtered till it gets to you is also part of that as well.
Right. I mean, the supply chain can get really long when we look at importing food from South America. And when you think of how many times it's changed hands or changed trucks or changed warehouses, you can imagine how tracing something like that back to where it came from to find a source of a problem is very difficult.
Because you are producing here locally and you have greater contact with the people who are buying your meats, do you feel that the average consumer has a reasonable grasp on the realities of food production, or do you think there's a need for greater education?
Oh, I think there's a great need for education. I don't think people realize that as they build their dinner every night, how far and where that food came from. When you start thinking about, you know, the lettuce on your plate traveling 1,500 miles and however many weeks it took to get there, people just don't realize that as soon as it's picked, it starts deteriorating. So, you know, it loses nutritional quality. There's a whole range of problems with the lack of education. And, you know, food is really an agricultural act and a health act. So I think if we could educate people to think about everything they put in their mouth, where it came from, how it was produced, how long it's been sitting there, we could have a healthier population.
As I understand, you're currently providing the grass-fed beef and lamb and naturally raised pork, but you are also trying to expand upon our ability to process those meats here locally. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have always had a problem getting meat processed to a large enough capacity to grow my business. So I started looking at building my own processing facility and talked to a lot of people that I eventually got a USDA rural development grant to do a feasibility study on a larger plant. And I've been thinking about this and sort of working with the numbers for 2 years. Right now, I've decided to take ownership of that as a cooperative with, you know, up to 500 additional ranchers on the Western Slope. And the reason I've done that goes back to the profitability of the ranchers. The rancher and the farmer and everything tends to get a very small percentage of that retail dollar that people spend on food. So by having the ranchers own the processing plant and own a brand coming out the other end, so the label will be owned by the cooperative and, you know, ultimately the ranchers that belong to the cooperative, they'll get a larger piece of that retail dollar. So that's what I'm working on right now. It keeps moving forward, and it'll be great for our community because we will then have enough meat in our region to be able to feed our region.
What about in terms of jobs? Would there be a certain number of jobs created through that process as well? I would imagine.
Yeah, if we manage to get the processing facility built, it'll create about 105 direct jobs. And then when you think about trucking and, you know, the availability of meat for value adding, like making jerky or dog food or, you know, sort of any other product, it should really stimulate the food economy in the area.
Something that we've seen in the media recently is this idea of lab-grown meats. I definitely want to get your opinion on that as someone who is pursuing a more naturalistic raising of cattle. We go to this opposite extreme of we don't even need the cow. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as a scientist, you know, I think it's cool that you can raise cells in a petri dish. On the other hand, someone who's actually raised cells on a petri dish and realizes that to be able to do that, you have to have fungicides and bactericides and some sort of nutritional medium. I think the chemical additives in that or the residues in it will be a greater problem than we already have from natural meats. So to me, I would never eat it just because I know how they're going to have to raise it. And, you know, when you think about what consistency of meat they can produce, you know, a few years back, we had the big thing about pink slime. And if you thought that was sort of disgusting, how can you even consider cultured meat?
What do you think is driving that?
You know, actually, I never think that it will be commercially available because the expense of producing it will make it unaffordable. But I think everything's driving it, the sustainability issues, the animal welfare issues, and just sort of people's perception of, you know, the conventional way to produce meat right now. It makes it sort of attractive until you educate yourself about it, what it really is.
There was also an article recently in the Sentinel about this idea of gene editing and some of the people behind it saying we can help reduce some of the animal cruelty by genetically altering our cattle to be able to withstand certain conditions. I'd love to get your opinion on that.
So that technology is called animal husbandry, and we've been breeding some of these things out of our cattle or into our cattle for centuries. And so this is sort of an instant gratification way of doing animal husbandry. My concerns are genes aren't singular. They don't just have one action. So when you remove or add a gene, it changes multiple things about that animal. So, you know, while visibly you might notice you've just made it so all cattle don't have horns, you have to wonder what other damage you've done on making that, because we really, while our understanding of the genome is increasing all the time, we're not there yet. So I would hesitate to make it sort of prevalent in our animal herds just in case we've done some terrible damage and suddenly we've wiped out the population of that species, which is possible.
There are definitely some threats to ranching right now. How do you feel overall? Do you feel hopeful about the future of this industry?
You know, it's changing, and people are really, there's a whole new young generation coming on that want to do things completely different. So I usually this time of the year when things quiet down, I'm able to attend some of the meetings in the area. So I've gone to Regenerate, which was three different groups meeting and talking about regenerative agriculture. And there's so many innovative things going on that just excite me and give me so much hope for the future. Things that you wouldn't think of, like, you know, well, the whole aquaponics movement and all that. It's so cool in arid areas where it uses so much less water and how much you can grow. And, you know, different ways of moving cattle across the landscape and really improving the ground that the cattle on, using the cattle, not degrading it like we have been. So I'm very hopeful about the future. I just love that the young people, you know, college-educated young people are actually leaving careers at Wall Street or, you know, in factories or in management and coming back and wanting to do something interesting on the land. And that's how innovation happens.
So, Catherine, I did want to congratulate you. I read in the paper recently that you were selected for Governor-elect Polis's transition team. So give us some insight into what work that entails and how that could positively impact Colorado ranching moving forward.
So I'm working with former Governor Bill Ritter and Andrew Curry as our co-chairs, and we are looking to fill the cabinet positions in agriculture, energy, and natural resources. So we've developed some metrics to help us decide who to put forward to the governor, and we're going to be reading through. I think I've got on my desk over 100 resumes of people who have applied for those three positions. So our job is to select a few for interviews and then ultimately get a few in front of Governor-elect Polis. And we've got some great applicants. So I'm very excited about going forward. Governor-elect Polis has a very progressive agenda. He really wants to bring the rural areas into Denver and into the governor's house and be able to have more consensus on what happens in our legislative rather than, having the Front Range where most of the population is call all the shots. And I'm really excited about that. I don't think I've lived in this state for 30 years now, and I don't think a transition team has ever reached out as far into the community to get the input at this stage of the game. And that really excites me. And I think it's real. And I think he really does want to bring the rural populace into his decision making. I mean, we don't elect the politicians. We sort of get whoever gets selected by the rest of the population. And I think it's so hopeful that he's actually reaching out to the rural areas and trying to figure out what it is he can do in his position to help bring us, sort of forward as the rest of the state has been moving, because the rural areas have really been left behind out of the economic development, out of pretty much everything that goes on as far as increase in wages and all that. We just haven't felt it over here. And that's important to him. I think starting today, he has some listening sessions going on even before he chooses people for these cabinet positions. So if you go on his website, Boldly Forward, and click on events, it shows you where you can call in or where you can turn your computer on and give him input now into what you want to see in these positions.
So, Catherine, before we leave today, we need to let our listeners know how to find your products.
Well, that's easy. I have a retail store in Fruita on Aspen Ave, right on the circle. Also, during the summer, a couple of other small stores carry it. Blaine's Farm Stand in Palisade carries it. Osage Gardens in Newcastle carries it. And then the Moab Farm, Moonflower Cooperative also carries it. I do not ship, but you can find it on the menu of your favorite restaurant in town as well.
That's great. Catherine, thank you so much for being here today. This has been a very eye-opening discussion for me, and you've left me and hopefully our listeners feeling very positive about the future of ranching here in Colorado.
That's great. That's exactly what I want to convey, because that's how I feel. Thank you for having me.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in to our last edition of 2018. We're busy planning our first slate of podcasts for the new year, so remember to follow us on Facebook and now on Instagram at Crossing the Divide to keep up on latest releases and other events. While you're there, feel free to message us with ideas you might like us to explore in future casts. Crossing the Divide is also available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. Find us on any of those platforms and hit subscribe to stay plugged in. We're looking forward to bringing you more local voices in 2019. Crossing the Divide, cultivating community through conversation.